The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The 605, the 101, the 101, the 101, the I-10, the 210, the 605, the 101, the 405, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light.
Everybody, Los Angeles, California. It's Eddie Solis, host of Los Angeles Nista. Welcome to the 10th episode. I appreciate everyone listening. And our studio audience, big round of applause for the studio audience tonight. Yeah, I'm standing up because I'm super duper excited. I'm not going to sit down like some lazy radio host and just like sulk and stare at the wall and wait for my guests to come on. No, I'm standing up because tonight's the 10th episode. We got world-renowned skateboarder Mike Vallely in the house as our guest. His city of choice is Long Beach, California. We're going to discover what Mike likes to do in Long Beach, and then I'm going to explain to everyone out there, how do you get there via public transportation from every direction in LA County? So I'm going to put my public transportation skills to use and inform you how to be car-free like me. So don't forget, we're taking calls, 1-800-893-9562. And we want everyone to talk to Mike about his new band, Good For You. It's killer because Mike is on vocals and Greg Ginn, the founder of SST and creator of the Mighty Black Flag, is on guitar. And Mike actually just flew in today from rehearsal. They're rehearsing out at Greg's compound in Denton, Texas. And he's here tonight. When we come back, we're going to get Mike on the air. We're going to start the segment. We're going to talk about Good For You. We're going to talk about his movie appearances. We're going to talk about his new company, Elephant Brand. And we're going to take some calls, get into some LA Nista format with public transportation. But before we do that, we want to let everyone know that next week we got Martin Wong from Giant Robot. And it looks like the week after that we got Alfredo Ortiz, who's known for his work in the Beastie Boys and Los Lobos, percussionist, currently doing a band called the Bongoloids. And on the 18th, we got world-renowned photographer Edward Culver, who shot the Damage cover and all kinds of other great album covers, like the Chili Peppers and Ice Cube and all that good stuff. So, and also confirmed, but waiting on confirmation, we got Lars Fredriksson of Rancid. He's going to be coming in. And we got Jack Grisham of Joy Killer and TSOL. We're going to get into a Grateful Dead vibe because Greg Ginn is a huge Deadhead. And there's a local band called Punk is Dead. They do Grateful Dead renditions in pop punk format. So we're going to listen to that. We're going to listen to some Good For You. Come back, get Mike on the air, and we're going to get this going. Call us at 1-800-893-9562. All right, Punk is Dead. We'll be right back.
honey, come along with me. We'll be right back.
right, welcome back to Los Angeles Nista. I'm your host, Eddie Solis. Welcome to the 10th episode. Give us a call, 800-893-9562. And it's my pleasure to welcome and introduce to all of you, my friend and yours, Mike V. Mike, thank you for coming.
Hey. Thanks, Eddie. Thanks for having me, man. It's good to see you, buddy.
Yes, it's good to see you also. And I want to let everyone know, you know, I've always aligned with like hard work with like, you know, Grey Ginn, SST, Black Flag. And like, even what you do, you've always had like relentless work ethic in skateboarding and business. You just got off an airplane a few hours ago from Good For You rehearsal with Ginn. You were out in Texas.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we weren't really rehearsing just yet. We were tweaking some music for a second follow-up release.
Oh, you guys are already on a sophomore effort?
Yeah, to the release that hasn't even come out yet.
I love it.
We got a lot of material. There's a lot of music there. So, I was out there for the weekend working on that stuff.
That's great. You know what? I just want to bring everyone up to speed. We have got listeners. I know there's some people that don't know who Mike V is. So I want to paint a picture and do this. Tell everyone how you started skateboarding and what your first tier of professional skateboarding was like with like Pau Peralta. How did you get sponsored?
Well, I was just skateboarding in a parking lot, basically. You know, right. I attended a professional skateboard contest as a spectator.
Okay.
And it was a different time in skating. Vertical skating was that was the big show. And street skating was new and it was emerging, and that's what I was mostly doing was street skating. So I went to this professional contest and I was skating in the parking lot, and I was sort of, I guess, discovered there.
Who discovered you?
Well, Neil Blender was the first skater that saw me and, you know, whoa, what's happening here? But Lance Mountain basically kind of was the guy that I guess in a sense discovered me. And then he introduced me to Stacy Peralta. And then they asked me to be on the team, which was Pau Peralta, Bones Brigade, which was the biggest team in skateboarding in the 80s.
Right.
So that was, it was crazy because I went from being a street rat to, I might as well have been Tony Hawk or Steve Caballero, because of my entry point was a turning point in the history of skateboarding.
Right, everything was going to street as public domain came out.
So, well, before that, when Pau Peralta sponsored me, that was like that's what signaled the turn, you know? So the attention paid to me and my skating overnight was, too much for a young kid to handle.
Right. So as the transition happened, you were already like in the Bones Brigade on Pau and filming your parts for public domain, and all the press was just,
well, I think they wanted things to move slower, but there was just too much, there was too much interest.
And
my skating was progressing fast, you know? It's like once I was in that mix and skating with the best skaters in the world, I just was adapting so quickly, picking up so much that I started to progress in advance what was happening in the streets. And they couldn't slow it. You know, the industry itself, my sponsors couldn't slow it down. Skateboarding in the streets was happening faster than skateboarding as an industry. And I became one of the faces of that. And so instead of being amateur for a couple of years and doing that circuit, I basically turned pro, you know, within a year of getting sponsored. And that wasn't really the plan, and that wasn't the type of timeline that had existed before me. But it was just the way it went. And it was an elevated situation. It wasn't something I was really quite ready for.
Gotcha. So on through your skate career, you went, you know, you graduated from Pau. You went to different companies like World Industries, Black Label, et cetera. You're always skateboarding. You always had a professional career. And tell me, what is the first band you did?
Well,
musically.
Well, I wouldn't say I graduated from Pau. I quit.
You quit. Thanks for clarifying. That's how we got you on here.
Yeah, I did not
Yeah, I'm trying to paint a nice picture for everybody.
Yeah, I, you know, here I am.
Why did you quit?
I was disillusioned with the business of skateboarding. And I never really felt comfortable. I never could handle the sort of collision of art and commerce. You know, I didn't see myself as I was very reluctant to be businesslike about my skating. My skating was my art form. It was the way I expressed myself. So when I felt like people were trying to control that, manipulate it, you know, tell me how to skate, where to skate, what to wear, you know, I went to a trade show in Long Beach and, you know, I was already out the door with Pal Peralta. I knew I was going to quit. And we were all supposed to wear the same kind of uniform. It was like it was a military themed, the trade show had our trade show booth had a military theme. And it was called Camp Motherhood. And we all had dog tags and these, you know, identical shirts. And it was sent to me to wear. And I just left it at the house, you know, or the hotel, wherever I was at. And I just showed up with a Ramones t-shirt on. And Stacy Peralta said, "Hey, man, you're wearing a Ramones t-shirt. What do you, you know, you're supposed to be wearing Camp Motherhood, man." And I was like, "No one tells me what to wear, man, you know." And it was, that was the beginning of the conversation that led to me quitting.
Got it.
You know, and this guy was and is a hero of mine. You know, it's like, and so people hear these stories all the time and they think there's like this bad blood and
it's not even about that, right?
Yeah. It was just where I was at. You know what I mean? And I'm not there now. I'm not like, I don't cling to this stuff or like, you know, I'm not like hung up on it.
And you always move on.
Yeah. But I was just like, I'm out of here, man. I didn't care. It's like I was ready to just quit skating. You know what I mean? It was like I felt like it was murdered. It was just like dragged through the mud. It was no longer something that they were making. My willingness to participate at some level just made it so uncomfortable. It was like, why am I doing this? This isn't why I started. You know. So, fast forward. So I have a 26-year pro career at this point. So that's 26 years of basically torture in a sense. However, you know, I don't mean to paint a negative picture. I love what I do and I've made peace with it in a sense. And I've always felt like the power of skating and the reason that I skate and the act of my own skating has always sort of been my escape from the business of skating. I've been a very reluctant businessman, you know, and it's helped me. And it's hurt me. And it's made things very interesting along the way.
Gotcha. So let's talk present day. You have your own company called Elephant Brand.
Yep.
Okay. How long has that existed for?
Just over a year now.
Yeah, it's fairly new. And tell us your mission statement with that. I mean, when you created that vision to do it, what did you tell yourself? What kind of company is this going to be for you?
Well, I've taken a stab at doing my own brand previously, but it was never truly my own company. It was always this sort of collaborative type of environment, or I was given the opportunity to have a brand that had my name or my image attached to it. But I was always just a working skater, so I wasn't ready to sit behind a desk or run a company. So it was like, Mike, you go on tour, you go skate, and we'll take your name and we'll make this company. And that doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. You know, it's like, so all the companies I've done in the past, they didn't truly have my fingerprint on them. Best intentions a lot of times, but just not, it wasn't my vision. I was always having to compromise because I was working with other people or working with other people's money or something, you know? And this time out, it's my vision. 100% my vision and my ideas and it's totally complementary of my style of skating and the way I think about skating, the way I view skating. So this is the first time I've ever had a skateboard company or a skateboard brand or board company that its product is, you know, in line with who I am. You know, I skated for Element for 7 or 8 years or something. And, you know, it was a great sponsor, paid the bills, but it was all it was. You know, it wasn't going to go anywhere. And I'd walk into a skate shop and see 10 of my boards on the wall that I'd never seen before, you know?
What do you mean? So you wouldn't even see the designs?
No, I had no, they were renting my name, you know, and then they just do whatever they want with that. So I go into a skate shop, I go, oh, that's my new board, I guess, you know?
Wow.
And coming from where I come from, and that's pretty standard today, where I come from and how I view skateboarding and skateboards, it's a little bit more sacred than, you know, more sacred than that. It's, you know, when you put out a pro model, that's like putting out a record. It's your baby.
Artwork, shape.
Everything.
It's going to be here for a while.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And all of that all of that's evaporated. It's been taken away. It's just like, it's supply and demand. There's no, you don't find that like extra love behind the product. It's just like churning it out. And that just is gross to me.
Yeah.
And I still feel like I got that slime on me from being involved in that kind of thing for so long. So at this stage, how could I even, like, I'm not about to try to enter the skateboard market and do a company and like basically bottle cola and go up against Coca-Cola. Like, what's the point? You know? So I said, what do I want to do? And I made a company based on what I would want. And I thought, well, no one's going to care. And it's going to just crawl under the radar and that's okay. But it turns out that I think there's a lot of people ready for that. So Elephant's 1 year going now, and it's very positive, very healthy, and it's the best thing I could have done.
Yeah, it seems really... very, you know, there's like a non-ego presentation it has. When you go on the, when you go see the imagery and the website and the Facebook, it just seems like, you know, if anyone has anything to say when they buy an Elephant board and send you a picture, then you put it up.
Yeah.
And it's very proactive with your fan base.
Well, it's for the individual skater. And it's not catered to the mass identity of skateboarding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in that. I don't care about the X Games. I don't care about Street League. I don't care about the corporate sponsors or, you know, I care about the individual skater and the experience that that person has on a skateboard. That's what I relate to. That's who I am. So the whole like filter of hype has been removed. There's none of that with this company. It's skateboarding. And it's for the discerning skateboarder. It's not an entry level. Although we have a lot of kids, young people that are responding to what
right,
we're doing.
Because you make the smaller sizes.
Right. But it's not about like, you're a new skater. Here's your, you know, this is your first board. It's about a skater who kind of knows what he wants, he or she wants, you know? And I think that's drastically different than what a lot of people have been doing for a long time in skateboarding. They're just kind of, they make products, right?
Mass produce.
They just make them because, oh, you know, it's product categories. There's no, and it's all these like seasonal, like, what are we doing this season? What is our ad campaign this season? What is, you know, who are we trying to relate to this time? Who, you know, who are we going to whore out this time? And Elephant doesn't really have any of that and never will.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty transparent from the outside looking in. Through myself or someone else that I know that skates and they may be 21 or 31 or 41. I think that message is pretty solid. Like that message that you send out, everyone, I think grasps that pretty clearly.
And I think that's always been very present in my actual skating.
Yep.
But I never had a company that I was working with that conveyed the same message. So that made my career very kind of, sort of muddied. You know, it's like saying one thing and doing another in a sense. And that, so there's a contradictory type of thing that's happening there. Well, it's paying the bills,
right.
You know,
right.
but it makes for a frustrating type of, you know, situation that I've really had a hard time dealing with. And that burden's been lifted off my back in starting Elephant.
Right, right. Do we still have a caller on the line? Okay, we're nowhere near done, but we're going to take this caller. They've been waiting.
Sure.
All right, let's take it. You're on the air with Los Angeles Nista in studio guest Mike V. What's up? Hello? Ten, nine, eight, seven, six,
caller.
Five,
caller, are
four,
you there?
Three, two, one, you're out of here. So we tried. Now, as far as what you were saying, I'm going to make a right turn here. As what you were saying about the individuality, being, you know, something that wasn't really exposed through the main industry. When you brought that up, that message that you care so much about, it's about the skateboarder. I think at one point in your career, you had a show called Drive.
Yep.
And I think when you would actually create the content for that, that was the message you were trying to give these kids.
Oh,
and
definitely.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us the premise of that show?
Well, the initial premise of Drive was, you know, the idea that as a professional skater, I was always traveling the world and skating with skaters. And, you know, this was at a time when skating was really starting to come into prominence, and crossing over, transcending into sort of the mainstream in a way. And the idea of like, well, would a professional baseball player ever go play baseball with kids, you know,
at that level,
it doesn't happen, you know, it's like, and this is something that had been happening in skateboarding since I started skating. So the idea was like showing up unannounced at skate parks and interacting with skaters. And it was at a time when, you know, my skating was at a level that was very high. My presence in, you know, I was considered one of the top guys, you know what I mean?
Right.
I was having my 15 minutes of fame. And so what I asked myself, okay, here I am. What do I want to do with this? And that's what I wanted to do with it. I wanted to strip it all the way back down to the grassroots. You know, it was like, I was on the bus, on the tour, headline status. So what do I want to do? I want to go all the way back to the roots, you know? And it was the only way I could cash the checks, man. You know, it was the only way I could feel good about the money I started making and the attention I was getting. It was like, I got to do something. You know, I got to get out there and do something. And people say, oh, you really give back. I didn't look at it like giving back. I just looked at it like being righteous.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, connecting with.
Not so much giving back, but passing on, you know, like I felt like I got this far. I got so far down the road with my skating. Like, well, the kids who are entering now, I want them to experience it the same way I experienced it. And I understood that as skating was sort of going mainstream, sort of going sport, sort of going athletics, that the idea of self-expression, art, creativity, individuality was in danger. And I wanted to keep that as a talking point. As
integrity.
I wanted to keep that as something that was on the forefront. So I purposely put myself on the front lines. You know, I didn't have to.
No.
I mean,
at that time, let me interject. I mean, when you were doing Drive, I mean, you were on Element. You were, you know, coming out on Viva La Bam. You had Drive and, you know, beverage sponsors. I mean, you had a huge platform, you know, Sobe, all that. And you could have done whatever you want. So, I mean, to do that at that level, you know, no one else was doing that kind of thing.
No, but it's what I knew. It's what I felt right. You know, what I felt was right. And it was a lot of fun too, man. I mean, I got to go to some great places, meet great people.
You traveled the world all the time.
It was a continuation of what I'd always been doing, but now it was just an intensified season, you know?
Let's take a call.
Sure.
All right. Los Angeles Nista, you're on the air with Mike V. What's up? 10, 9, 8.
Say
seven,
something.
6, 5.
Hello?
Hi, who is this?
Oh, hey, hang on a second.
This is
drummer. Drummer, it's Michael Lay's radio show. I have drummer Greg Moore. He's going to be playing with Mike Lay in Good For You, and he just wanted to call and say hello on his radio show.
Is this Greg Moore?
Yeah, hang on, here he is.
Let's get Greg Moore. Drummer, that's drummer,
wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Hey, who's this?
Hey, drummer, it's Eddie.
What's up, Frank?
What's up? Where are you? Are you
in the,
are you making drums? Are you making drums? Are you making drums?
Not so much these. You mean the hand drums?
All right, we got Mike V right here. Say what's up to Mike.
Yay, Mike.
Drummer, what's up, man?
Oh, my God.
I don't think people understand, but this is...
I am blown away. I can't wait to come jam with you.
Drummer's doing the Black Flag reunion, right?
Well, it's not a reunion. It's a reformation. And drummer's going to be playing with Greg with Black Flag, but drummer's also going to be drumming with Good For You.
Oh, okay. So he's been Good For You, too. Yeah. See, Good For You is...
I got a new name. Hey, I got a new name, guys.
What is it?
I'm still drummer to you guys.
Yeah, because we're OG.
Reverend Romeo Amore.
Reverend Romeo Amore? Okay, yeah. Now, do you still have an ambulance?
No, I got past that. That only has a history of itself, that's for sure. But, no, I have a tent. I still have a tent.
You still got a tent? Is it in the hills of Topanga?
I've been living in a tent, yeah.
That's the shit right there.
But, you know,
that's the real deal.
Texas, T for Texas, baby. And I'm going from Topanga to Taylor.
That's right.
Tomorrow.
Now, let me tell you, this guy's a real deal. Gregory Moore, okay, is a active musician that has played with Greg Ginn throughout the years and has done his thing with Greg when Greg does Black Flag or the Greg Ginn Band. And we know him as drummer. And it's so righteous because...
But he just pulled a Snoop line on us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even though he does, like... He's got a place...
I'm a bass player. I'm really Dale Nixon. I've been lying to you bitches.
He gets... Is this Dale Nixon? Is this Dale Nixon?
No, Dale Nixon does not make phone calls.
The real bass player should show up with a T-shirt and say, I am the real Dale Nixon. You might get the gig.
I know. But the best thing about drummer is he really lives in a tent in Topanga on the hills. He makes his own drums, and when he's called on, he makes the trek from T to T, Topanga to Texas, to do his thing.
Well, the main thing is a relentless driving drum style.
Exactly.
You know?
Let's get there.
I tell you, Mike, I heard it, and you guys are in for a treat. I ain't saying much about it, but I'm impressed. I'm really excited to be a part of this project.
And drummer, when you go to Texas.
The other's icing on the cake, but you know, it starts with Good For You.
Nice. Well, he's heading to Texas tomorrow.
I go, hey, man, I'm not homeless anymore, and I'm not on food stamps. I got a gig. And they go, I didn't come to the music gig. They go, man, that's Good For You. And I went, That's the best,
dude. Good For You.
And you know, it's not
food stamps anymore. It's the EBT card. It's the EBT card.
You know,
we accept. Everybody accepts EBT.
I don't have a gig yet. Wait, I don't have a gig in case the government's listening. I've let go of that. But I told them without any of this happening, I was on for over a year. I really was. No bullshit. It actually helped save my life. And I said, you know what? Thank you. I'm done. I don't need the money. Someone else does. But I have to say, I have been there, and that's just sometimes reality. But I'm excited to do music, man. That's all I can say. Well,
it's just so easy. You're part of the conversation. Don't go. I mean, right. Do you still have your ambulance?
No. I gave it to a guy at Topanga, and then he ended up selling it, and then it got towed away, and they never did the paperwork, and Malibu called me and said, hey, you owe us for a towing fee. I went, that's not cool.
What'd you tell him?
Anyway, no.
Did you even respond?
I just told him, I said, I'm in my tent. Come find me.
I'm in my tent.
Send me the bill, please. You just got to cross the creek and hope the hawk don't get it. Don't worry about it.
I mean, it's just so heavy that you're rolling with Ginn to do Good For You and Flag and all. You know, you got the crust punks that are begging for money, but their parents live on the hills, but you're actually living in a tent. By choice, off the radar.
Yeah,
off the radar.
I'm still in a tent. I moved out. I'm out, not outside anymore. I'm actually in a commercial building.
That's fine. But I'm just saying.
It's
just like everything that you do is just so heavy because you mean it. You know?
Oh yeah, dude. I'm still barefooted. I've been barefooted for 20 years.
You've been barefooted for 20 years. I know you have.
Reverend Romeo.
Not even flip flops. Just barefooted for 20 years.
I'm gonna be looking fancy on tour. I'll have. You know, you got to have the right, you know, I'm not here to push it on people. I got my life, but I'll walk in. There's some clubs, you know, I'll just get naked on stage or take my shoes off on stage. But,
dude, I'm so stoked you called because I've actually missed you so
Daddy.
Much.
I am Daddy. It's good to hear you guys, and I'll be talking. We continue the conversation, but I just want to send you good love, good vibes, and I hope I don't know what you're doing musically. I hope you're doing things too.
All right, drummer.
All right, drummer.
Good to hear you, Eddie. Good to see you, Mike.
Yeah,
see you
I'll
later.
Be seeing you in Taylor,
bye.
Man.
Bye. Bye-bye. Right.
Okay, let's get back to it. Everyone, that's Gregory Moore, a.k.a. Drummer. That's the drummer for Good For You, the new band by Greg Ginn and Mike Vallely. So now, As far as where we went with your skate career, you know, you're really active with Elephant Brand and you're doing a lot of music these days. Okay, let's steer into that. Let's talk about music. Okay, good for you. Tell us what that is.
Well, it's a band.
The band? Who's in the band?
Myself, Mr. Ginn.
Okay.
And as you just heard.
Drummer,
Gregory Moore. We're still auditioning bass players at this point.
Right.
It'll be a little bit before we announce who that's going to be.
Still looking for that Gene Simmons, I heard.
It'd be great if Gene was available. don't think he is right now.
Gotcha.
But that style, that ability on bass, that would be amazing, you know?
Totally.
We got a record coming out February 26th on SST.
SST is back putting new releases out. This is going to be available on LP Wax and download at iTunes.
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, are there any bonus tracks on either the format or is it just straight up the same thing?
Straight up. And we're, like I said, when we started, we're already working on a second release right now. So, and that might be good chance that'll be a double LP.
Killer.
So there's a lot of material, a lot of music going on and, but you know, it's all in the can right now.
Right.
So the next thing is just getting on the road and that starts in April. Yeah.
Okay. Now let me ask you a question. Where did this material come from? I know Greg, you know, has a huge catalog, a log of music. Yeah. Now, is this something that you guys started fresh with or what? Did he pull music out of the Greg Ginn vault and start laying lyrics?
This music's fresh and it's new. He, you know, back in 2003, around the time of the reunion shows, Greg said, hey, you know, I'm going into this, you know, he went into this long period of time of doing instrumental music. And he said, well, you know, if I get around to, when I get around to doing music that's going to have vocals, I would love to have you be a part of that. And I was like, cool. That was 2003.
Yep.
You know, and we kept in touch on and off through the years. Like, you know, I check in every now and then. He's like, yeah, I'd love to do something. Just not ready, you know. Doing this, I'm doing that. And we talked. And then one day I got an email from him with a Dropbox attachment. You know, a lot of material. And so he has these amazing creative outputs. And he just went into it going, okay, this is music that's going to have vocals. And he sent it to me. And there was no real plan in place.
Right.
It wasn't like, we're going to do a band. And we're going to put out a record. We're going on tour. the music came first.
And we're going to sell our stuff at Hot Topic.
Yeah. It was just about the music, you know?
Right.
And then once it became real, once we had music and it wasn't something like, hey, nice try, buddy, go home. Once it was like, hey, we dig it. You know, let's move forward. Okay, now what? Okay, let's do a band and let's put this out and let's hit the road. And so I took it as like, well, this is an amazing season of life that Greg's stepping into now. And I was just like really, really glad to be here for it. You know, that's how I feel. I'm just really glad to be here for it. You know, people are a lot of people, since it's been announced that I'm working with Greg, oh man, you must be so stoked. You're working with Greg again. How does that, you know, he's such a legend. And, you know, he's more inspiring to me now on a daily basis than it being some like looking back type of thing.
Right.
You know, yeah, in 1984, the first band I ever saw was Black Flag and it was as heavy as it gets. But that's not what this is about. This is about a relationship that is happening now, you know?
It's in the moment, truly.
Yeah, it really is. And that's the only way he operates, you know? He doesn't care about what happened decades ago. I don't care about what happened decades ago. We're living right now and this is very exciting to us.
Exactly. So this comes out February 26th on SST, right? Available at iTunes, you know, digitally at all the digital service providers and vinyl. We're going to get into some good for you right now. We're going to take a break. Call us at 800-893-9562. Let's play some good for you. This is track 2, and we're going to let it play for a while. All right.
pay for yourself.
Here I am, I laugh at you, all of your hatred.
Welcome back to Los Angeles Nista. Hey, that was good for you. We just heard two songs. Mike, what was that?
Did we hear two or three?
I think it was two. It might have been a good three.
What was tracks two and three?
Let's say it was
two. Track two is a song called No Plan B.
Ah.
And then track three is a song called Free. And then we did hear three tracks. The fourth track is the song called Hanging Around.
Killer. Okay, so for everyone that's joining us, Los Angeles Nista, we got Mike V in the studio. Call us 800-893-9562. That's 800-893-9562. We just heard two tracks from Good For You.
Three
tracks from Good
it
For You.
It was three tracks, yeah.
And that Good For You is Mike V on vocals and Greg Ginn on guitar, out February 26th on SST Records. Pre-order it now through your independent record stores because you got to keep things totally DIY and independent. And, you know, like SST used to say in the stickers, corporate rock still sucks.
Yeah.
So I'm going to name check a few stores. If you're in Chicago and want to pre-order the LP at your store and support independent music, I think you should go to Reckless. They got three beautiful locations on Broadway, Wicker Park, and The Loop. Go in there, support brick and mortar, because it's all going away. And I think when there's record stores and bookstores, it's very important you go and give them your business. If you're not going to order it direct through SST, order it at your local record store. I know Reckless will have it. Walk in and get it. Actually, Lori's Planet of Sound is another store in Chicago. If you're in Texas, where SST is based out of now, go to Waterloo in Austin, End of an Ear in Austin, Sound Exchange in Houston, and Vinyl Edge in Houston. And there's good records in Dallas. Everyone in San Diego, go order Good For You on SST Records at Thirsty Moon and M Theory. LA, you got Vacation Vinyl. You got Fingerprints in Long Beach, Amoeba in Hollywood. And in San Luis Obispo, you have Boo Boo Records. Should I keep going?
Yeah.
Want me to go around the whole country?
It's impressive.
In the Valley, Sherman Oaks, you got Freak Beat Records. In Fountain Valley, you got TKO Records. In Huntington Beach, you got Electric Chair. In Buena Park, you got Bionic Records. In Claremont, you have Rhino Records. And in Santa Barbara, you have Warbler Records. In San Francisco, you have Amoeba. In Berkeley, you have Amoeba. And in Sacramento, you got a five-store chain called Dimple. You got Rasputin's in San Francisco and all the suburbs. And you have 1234 Go Records in Oakland. In Eugene, you have Skip CDs. And you have Portland.
He should change the name of that back to Skip's Records.
Skip's Records. And you got CD World. It's actually called Skip CD World. And in Portland, you got two jackpot stores. You got Everyday Music. You got Second Avenue. You have Beaverton, Oregon. You have another Everyday location. And in Seattle, you got Easy Street, Sonic Boom, Everyday Music. And in Bellingham, you got Avalon and Everyday Music. So we just covered San Diego all the way to the Canadian border.
Wow.
I was seeing a little bit of Chicago, a little bit of the heartbeat of America. We'll go east a little later on in the show.
And we hope to play all those places this year.
Yeah, but those are all the record stores that I know for a fact order SST stuff and will have this record. So, you know,
with
this show, yeah, you get it all. You get a well-rounded coverage. So, Mike, so let's get into your city of choice for Los Angeles Nista. Let's talk Long Beach, California.
Sure. That's where I live.
Okay, great. So what we do here at Los Angeles Nista is we have guests on and, you know, basically what Los Angeles Nista does is we want to let everyone know that you can come to LA without a car and get around. And it's so big. LA County is so big. You can experience things. So what I want to let people know is, you know, Long Beach is your choice. And let's start with skate spots. Are there any skate spots that you could let the skateboarders know about out there?
Well, you know, Long Beach is probably, if not the most progressive city in the United States, one of them as far as the building of skate parks. So the city of Long Beach has been tremendous in facilitating skaters. There's a guy in Long Beach, Mike Donilon, who's done so much on behalf of skaters and getting skate parks built. So, you know, that in itself is just huge for the locals, for the skaters in Long Beach. As far as spots go,
yeah. Is there any street spots or just cool banks to walls? You
know, yeah, there's plenty. I like to skate stuff that's not a bust. You know,
right? You could go and like hang for an hour.
Yeah, I like to go down. There's a lot of sort of DIY created spots down in the ditches. You know, basically San Gabriel River, stuff like that. You know, where it's just spillways. And
we take the push broom.
There's a lot of concrete, and there's a lot of guys going into these places with concrete and building these places up and creating their own skate spots. That's really kind of where things have evolved to at the sort of grassroots core level, is the DIY type of mentality taken to making places skateable. And they're usually places that are, you know, out of the way, under the radar, that aren't going to draw a lot of attention. There's just too many participants riding skateboards these days. You know, when I started as a street skater in 1984, I was one of I was like the first generation of street skaters. So this had never existed before, you know. Today, it's, you know,
oversaturated.
Yeah, it's like, you know, a spot doesn't last because everyone goes to it and, you know, blows it up to the point where, you know, everything's a bust, you know.
Sure.
And I'm not really... That's still a big part of my skating, is the streets. That's actually the most, that's what I relate to, is street skating. That's what I'm about, really. But in saying that, I don't have spots. I don't think in those terms like, oh, okay, this is a good spot. I think in the terms of skating, moving, adapting to the environment.
To what's available now.
Right.
In the moment.
Yeah. It's all spontaneous. I don't go out going, oh, I'm going to go skate this spot. I just go skating, you know? And yes. And sometimes that's going from one place to the next and going to a spot, but that isn't my focus or my emphasis. It's gotcha. About the actual act of just riding. And I like it like that because I like keeping it fresh. I like keeping it spontaneous. I don't like premeditating anything on my board.
Gotcha. I'm going to take a right turn really quick. We're going to go a little bit north of Long Beach. I just had an Oscar Bagarin of Whittier, California, wanted to say you did some of the sickest wall rides at Haters Alley.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Remember that place in Lakewood? That's Lakewood, right? Off Del Amo?
Yep. That's an old spot, man. That was a place that guys, I think they skated that in one of the old PAL videos, was Haters Alley. Steve Size. That was
public domain.
Yeah, public domain.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I've had some of the sickest wall rides there, but I've definitely done some wall rides in the alleyway.
There's pictures and video of them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I remember going back in the 90s. It's really long.
Yeah.
And actually, it looks a lot smaller on video.
It's tough. It's a tough spot to ride, you know? It's not quite as easy as it would appear.
Right, you know? Right. So what's going on with the city of Long Beach? Are there, like, relevant skate parks where people could go skate and just skate all day?
Yeah. There's plenty of them all over the place. And they're being used, you know, kids are going there and skating. Kids, I mean, skaters of all ages.
Right.
I generally just, when I mean to talk about skaters, I say kids.
Sure.
Because, well, skaters don't ever really grow up.
Right. You know? I have a question for you. Being that you're, you know, very well traveled, let me ask you a question. There's always been, when it comes to sports and music, there's always an East Coast, West Coast mentality.
Yeah.
Okay. What's up with East Coast and West Coast skaters? What's the difference? Can you nail it on the head? Is there a difference?
I think there is.
What is it?
Skaters from the East Coast aren't sunbathers.
Now, we got a Bostonian in here. Do you agree with that? Yeah.
You know, the streets are a little more rugged. Right. The environment's a little bit more rugged.
In the East Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have more weather that you have to deal with, you know. When I started skating, you know, we skated through the seasons nonstop. There was nothing deterred us, you know. The terrain was just, you know, it's not really smoothly paved everywhere, you know.
You're right, right.
And
it's not made to skate in the East Coast,
yeah.
So to say.
It's just so skate crazy that it was just, you know, I mean, every waking moment that I wasn't at school or eating dinner, I was skating, you know? And when I came to California for the first time, I found out the skaters weren't quite as committed, you know? They're like, hey, do you ever stop? You know? And maybe it was an individual thing.
Cruise
but
control.
It's like, you know, hey, man, we skate, but then we go to the beach, you know? What? You do? Yeah. There's just too much to do in Southern California, I guess, you know? In Edison, New Jersey, man, it was like there was nothing to do until we started skating. And once we started skating, that's all we did.
You do that and then you run through cemeteries.
Well, if someone makes you.
well, there's this, I don't, for people out there, you know, Mike, your debut, was your Public Domain your debut?
No, I was in Animal Chin.
You're in Animal Chin also, but you had a bigger part in Public Domain.
Yeah, that was my sort of my own
pro
individual.
Debut.
Yeah.
Now, Public Domain was out in what year? Like 93?
88.
Well, that was 88, Public Domain?
Yeah, 88.
Shit. I think my problem is I kept watching it over and over for 4 years.
You watched it through to 93.
Yeah.
That's why you thought I was still
my
good
problem.
In 93.
No, but the thing is like, I remember this one scene that Mike was so known for was like, you know, he's just ripping it up on the street. Then like, he just pops his board up and runs to the cemetery. And then he just like, does like, you know, a boneless off the next side of it and just keeps going.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, it was killer.
It's interesting because I was, that was part of the reason I left Palo Peralto was that video part and that actual scene, me running through that graveyard. Cause I was so, you know, I was like, why do I have to do this? They're like, you have to run, you know, run through this graveyard. We'll follow you. And I didn't get it, man. I just didn't get it. There was some artistic video thing that was happening, but I just wasn't relating, you know?
Sure.
But, and the whole video part is kind of like that. My skating was so progressive at the time that it needed a little bit more room. And I wasn't being given the time or the room to like really express what I personally wanted to express at the time, which was the evolution of these tricks. So the video part was a little bit more stripped down. It was raw and it was me just kind of going, right?
Right.
And Stacy Peralta never gave me the chance to stop and really do what I wanted to do. Like really like explore the environment manipulate the environment further. He was just like, no, we got what we need. Let's move. And I was just like, this ain't cool, man. This is not what I wanted to put down. But you know what? In retrospect, looking back on it, he understood something about me and my skating that I wasn't able to understand at the time. And he communicated my skating better than I could have.
At that time.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to be... And I was, in a sense, I was emerging as the number one street skater, right?
Sure.
And that was about tricks. And there's plenty of tricks in the video part, but he really kind of stripped that back and made it about skating, moving. And that's all I really did, you know, but I wanted to communicate something else. But the thing that I wanted to communicate would have been trapped in time. And what he... was able to, the story he told about my skating was something that is timeless now.
Yeah, now when you watch it, it's like still translate true.
Yeah.
And it's timeless and fresh because
there's
it's
nothing,
all about the movement.
Right, there's nothing in that video part, there's nothing that I do that you would say is like, oh, well, that was cool for 88. It's just skating, it's cool.
Exactly, you know? The movement.
So that's pretty interesting because it was something that created so much turmoil, but in the end, I look back on and I go, wow. You know,
yeah, it's totally timeless.
I'm dumb
and priceless, you know. Now, since we're on that topic of that era, your classic first pro model with the elephant,
right?
Now, was that your choice?
Yeah,
okay, because
it was my idea,
right?
But it was something that I had to fight for, it wasn't something that was just given to me,
right? You had to really make a case of it and follow through on your end,
yeah. You know, like I said earlier, you know, my turning pro and my presence in skating at the time was one that was a turning point. And so with that being a turning point, they thought maybe a new direction with graphics, a new artist, a new, you know, this is the new thing. And I wanted the old thing.
Got it.
I wanted the VCJ, what I considered at that time already, I knew, timeless classic. That's what I wanted. And I had to fight for it though. They wanted to give me other graphics and it just never felt right. And it was very... There was just a lot of confrontation all the time about things. And I was never just going to get in line and just take it. I'd never accepted what they were just trying to give me or hand to me. I always fought for something more. And the elephant became, that was like a real sticking point. What, an elephant? Why do you want an elephant on your, you know, it's like, dude, what's wrong with a bug? What's wrong with a skull? What's wrong with a snake? Like, an elephant? That's not, you know, their graphics were very kind of bold and
predictable at the time.
Yeah.
So that was completely unpredictable when the elephant came out.
Yeah.
It was like, what's this about?
Yeah.
You know,
but
so, yeah.
Man, the board is so great, man. You know,
well, now you got the elephant brand.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. Tell me about how much work goes into your role in something like when you do The Hangover. You know, what we see, like, how much time does that actually take out of your day or week or days out of the week? I mean, it seemed like that'd be pretty taxing between that and Mall Cop.
No. Movies are like the easiest thing you can do.
Really?
Yeah. Just sit around your ass until you have to do something. You know, it's like, I worked on The Hangover for, I believe I was there for 3 days. And the scene that I'm in was just filmed in basically one day of coverage. But I was, the other stuff I did, I was actually, they filmed all of the driving scenes to and from Las Vegas in that weekend.
Okay.
And so I also was a stunt driver in the movie.
Right.
So all the cars on the highway they're not stunt drivers, they're like hired drivers, but then there's some that are considered stunt drivers and they are the guys in the cars closer to the action. So like when they cut off the big rig in the beginning of the movie and it slides out of control, you know, I'm in one of the cars behind the big rig, just driving it, you know? So I was hired as a stuntman, really. But the scene that I'm in, the tuxedo delivery scene, it's considered a stunt because I'm hanging out of a van going almost 70 miles an hour. They're not going to put an actor in that situation.
Sure.
So that's how I got the gig. But, you know, it was, to me, that's just like, that's easy stuff.
Walk in a park?
Well, compared to riding a skateboard,
right.
You know, it's like...
Well,
out of a van and throw some tuxedos, like, okay, you know, I could do that all day, man. You know?
Well, Mall Cop seems like you actually skated a lot more in that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now tell me, like, you know, the process behind that. I mean, obviously you guys did this after hours.
Yeah, what's cool about Mall Cop is I was there for the entire production of the entire movie.
Wow.
So,
was that shot in New Jersey?
It was shot outside of Boston.
Okay.
So we were in Boston the entire time. And then we would, shuttle out to the mall, which was like a half hour outside of Boston.
All right.
A lot of it was shot after hours when the mall was closed, but some of it was shot while the mall was open, you know. It was a cool experience. I really had a great time. Kevin James was just so great to be around on a daily basis.
Really?
He's everything you would think he'd be, you know. Like just,
that guy on TV, yeah, he's that guy.
Yeah, just a great guy. And, you know, it was his idea to involve the skate aspect in the movie. And so he was really kind of jazzed about having us there and working with us.
That's killer.
So there was a lot of attention and care given to those scenes. And I was allowed to be involved in an instrumental way in even the way the scenes were going to be filmed. And, you know, I wanted it to be legit and they wanted it to be legit. So they needed our expertise, my expertise in that type of scenario. So the stunts I got to do were great, you know? I think the coolest stunt, I mean, I jump the roof gap and, you know, which is great. But jumping onto a moving elevator was probably one of the cooler things I've done stunt-wise,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So how long was that window of work for you? I mean, like, how long did all that take?
I was there. I was in Boston for 2 months.
Oh, wow.
It's about 2 months of, you know, the movie was filmed in about 2 months. Yeah.
Gotcha. Now back to Long Beach. Okay. So tell me about when you're really busy, but when you actually have time to just kind of cruise around Long Beach, I'm going to get something to eat. Tell us about some of your favorite eateries there. Is there anything special that you could turn out to us, you know, all the listeners onto?
Well, where I live is a pretty cool little area.
Okay.
It's called, it's called Lakewood Village or it's called Parkview Village. And it's just kind of on the Lakewood border of Long Beach. And it's a little village is what it is. And so I live within walking distance of plenty of great places. There's a post office within walking distance. There's restaurants. My daughters both dance at a dance studio that's in walking distance from our home. So there's a Thai restaurant right by us, a cafe, Village Cafe, which is like a great breakfast spot. There's a Mexican restaurant, El Burrito Jr.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's great. You know, I mean, this is like, you know, Friday night, late, kids get done dancing late, it's like, I'm going to go pick up, get some takeout from the Thai place, you know? Right. It's like,
what's the Thai place called?
Pan Meruvian, I think. Something okay. Like, I don't know how to pronounce it. I think that's right.
What's some of your favorite dishes there?
Oh, I get, man, they got these great, great ribs, man.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I like Korean barbecue too. They do a Korean barbecue dish. Family gets the pad thai or
right
pad siu.
They chicken like pad thai.
Yeah, I don't really do the noodles, but I basically go straight to protein, man.
That's good. You know? So the fresh ribs.
Yeah.
Now, the Mexican joint, I mean, is there breakfast, lunch, and dinner served there?
Yeah, they're going all day, you know. We like to go down to Second Street.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a spot, Open Sesame on Second Street, which is a hot, I mean, everyone in Long Beach knows about that place to eat there.
What kind of food is it?
It's Lebanese.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's great, man. It's great. Hummus, you know.
The good stuff. Have you ever ridden public transportation in Long Beach? Have you ever been on the Blue Line?
No, I have not. I ride my bicycle a lot.
I see that.
Yeah.
I see that.
I actually ridden my bicycle to downtown LA from Long Beach.
Oh, how long ago?
I did it. The last time I did it was in late December.
You have a good time doing it?
Yeah. Yeah. I take right up the LA River, you know.
Really?
And then I cut off on the surface streets at a certain point. But yeah, it's, you know, I like kind of, what I like about bicycling is just it kind of slows everything down a little bit. And it's, you know, healthy exercise.
Exactly. So do you do most of, I mean, obviously I would assume that you do most of your bike riding starting in Long Beach and going outward.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've ridden to downtown Los Angeles. I've ridden to Costa Mesa where Elephant is based. Which is, I go all the way down to the beach, then along the beach, you know.
How long is that ride from home to Elephant?
Man, because sometimes you're against the wind, man, you know.
that really affects you, right?
It can be tough, man. It can be tough. It's like, you know, you start questioning yourself. What am I doing?
What am I made of, right? Yeah. Let's do it.
But you always get through it, you know. But I'll tell you, as a family, we've sort of recently just our mentality has been changing so much as far as like arriving in suburbia seemed like that was what we were supposed to do, buy a house
at the time.
Yeah, but you know, like we're all sort of like over it, you know. It's like I can really see us at some point moving into more of an urban environment where walking and bicycling and public transportation,
jumping on a bus that comes every 10 minutes to get, you know, on one side of
town, just makes more sense. And I think a lot of the things that we sort of bought into or believed to be like, oh, what you're supposed to do.
Sure.
They now sort of rub us the wrong way. I think I just think it's like they cling so hard to all these possessions and these things that they don't make any, if you're able to step back away from it all and just really look at it, none of it really makes any sense.
Or matters.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but you know, we're there. That's
right.
Where we are. And we're having these like realizations or, you know, epiphanies about like life, really, life in general.
Like,
you know?
Just your day to day. Just, yeah, I think a lot of people have this, they, you know, here's what I make. Here's my material things. Here's where I'm at. You know, at the end of the day, all these things don't matter.
Yeah. Well, they don't. And when you get there and you have them all, and what's next?
Well, you're still, that's a reality check of, okay, I'm responsible for making myself happy.
Yeah.
Things aren't going to make me happy.
Yeah.
It's nice to have these things, but that's not going to make me happy.
Well, it's when you're sort of in the rat race, you're always chasing the next thing. So there's no happiness in that at all, you know? So then it's like, what is a healthy lifestyle? You know, this isn't healthy. This is pressure cooker. This is high stress, you know, just like the whole deal, everything about it. And you're kind of, you know, it's in a way you're kind of led to believe like that's just normal. And then I just remember just fairly recently just going, this isn't normal. This sucks.
Wow. You know? That's pretty heavy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm, you know, like I said, we're there and we're there as a family and, so it's not something you can just step right out of, but there's definitely a transition happening in my own personal life.
For the next phase of you and your family's lives.
Yeah, what, like, you know, why are we anchored to this. We could, you know, we could be more mobile, you know?
Sure. And maybe too, your children are older now.
Yeah. That's definitely a part of it. My oldest daughter, Emily, who's 20, she's actually sort of spearheaded a lot of this thinking in our home. You know, she's sees things a little bit, you know, differently. New generation.
Through her eyes.
Yeah.
You know? Through the eyes of a 20-year-old.
Yeah. So, you know, she has ideas, she expresses them, and then, you know, like our parents before us, we try to chill her out, but then we realize she might be right. You know what I mean? You know? So I think to our credit, we're open. We're open.
Well, I'm going to interject really quick and explain to everyone listening live and everyone who's going to stream this tomorrow and download the podcast, how do you get to Long Beach? How do you get to Long Beach? So I'm going to start with my hometown turf, the East Side, East Los Angeles, Whittier, Pico Rivera, that whole side. It's super simple. For $1.50, actually, well, there's different ways you could do it. Say, for example, you wanted to do it and you live in Whittier. You would walk onto Whittier Boulevard and take the Montebello Line 10 bus westbound to the second to last stop, which is Beverly and Atlantic. You would get on the Gold Line. And you would take the Gold Line all the way to Union Station, an 18-minute ride, okay? From there, you would just go from Union Station Red Line, two stops to 7th and Metro, actually three stops. Go upstairs and you get on the Blue Line, straight shot to Long Beach. So the whole thing would be about an hour and 15 minutes. And the best thing to do would be to buy a day pass for MTA. Now, if you're coming all the way out from Whittier, it helps if you're going to be traveling a lot that month to buy the Easy Pass, because the Easy Pass is a all zone pass for $84 a month. And you could ride any bus agency in addition to the MTA. And it's $84 a month. So when you divide that by 30 days, it's $2.80 a day, unlimited travel. It's pretty amazing. So that's coming east to Long Beach. We'll get to other directions later. But
you used to actually do that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah. So I know this. I know all this from
That was a regular commute for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I would get on, you know, I lived, you know, between Whittier Boulevard and Beverly and Pico Rivera, right behind the Tommies. And I could go either.
Right behind the Tommies.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was an important dimension.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an institution in that area. You would get the picture of that I'm trying to draw.
Right.
So actually, you know, it would be one of two different ways. I could just skate to Whittier Boulevard, south of where I lived, a few blocks, or north to Beverly. And there's the Line 40 Montebello bus line on Beverly that goes to downtown. And then there's the line, there's actually, you know, the Line 10 on Whittier Boulevard. But what I would do at that time, I would just walk or skate from my house out to Whittier and Rosemead. And I would take the 266 southbound to the Green Line, Lakewood. And then I would go two stops and then get on the Blue Line, just straight shot. So that would take about an hour. But if you drove, it was the same thing.
Yeah.
Coming from that area. And you're like $8 a day, $9 a day, minimum. And stressed out and wear and tear.
Yeah.
And here, it's like I'm not binded to like a, you know, I call them the metal coffins.
Yeah.
You know, to the automobile. So you're just there. Like, it's like, all right, well, I'm going to hop off here for a few minutes, go get a coffee,
yeah,
or, oh, there's a rat skate shop, I'm going to go check it out, or
yeah,
a record store.
When I rode my bike downtown LA, it's about an hour, right?
Yeah.
Well,
in traffic?
I've you know, downtown LA from my home in Long Beach without any traffic.
35 minutes?
20 minutes, 25 minutes at the most.
Easy, yeah.
But I've done it, it's taken me 2.5-3 hours sometimes.
Sure.
On a bike, 1 hour.
Yeah, so go figure. You know, yeah, there's more pros than cons when you do all this.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, another great way for people to get to Long Beach is, like, say, for example, you live in Pasadena, okay? You could take the Gold Line towards LA. You get on the Gold Line and say, you know, say like you don't want the Easy Pass. You're coming just on metro territory, so you're not coming from different zones with different bus agencies. You would just, you know, get a $5 day pass. So that way you don't have to keep paying $1.50 every time you jump on something, like, because they charge you per ride, right? So you would definitely, you know, just get on the Gold Line, take it to Union Station, and then take the Red Line three stops to 7th and Metro, and then get on the blue line upstairs, and that's just straight shot to the water. It ends at the water. It's pretty easy.
How easy is it to get day pass? I mean, you buy that on the bus, or can you buy that at a station?
At a station, yeah. You get your tap card. There's a tap card, and it's $5, and it's good from, like, you know, 8 in the morning or just a full 24 hours. And it's pretty, you know, like, if you're riding a bike somewhere and you want to go see a lot, you could take your bike on.
Right.
You know, the goal line. Like, if say like there's a trail or something in Long Beach, or in Pasadena, and you're leaving Long Beach, you could take the blue line all the way to 7th and Metro. This is coming from Long Beach. You would go downstairs to the red line, take it on the side, going to Union Station, 3 stops, and then get on the goal line, going to Pasadena, and then there's whole new territory, foothills, and, you know, it's really simple. I mean, pretty much when we're describing, like, Whittier to Long Beach or Sierra Madre and, Pasadena to Long Beach or vice versa, or coming from Hollywood on the red line to Union Station and getting on the blue line, it's all about an hour to get anywhere, you know, from point A to point B.
Right.
So it's really easy.
So do you feel like the whole system is already set up in place and really functions well, or do you think this is something that still needs to evolve and grow and open up?
I think there's a great infrastructure in place, mm-hmm. because, for instance, you could really utilize it to your advantage, like how you were talking about placing yourself in a more fast-paced environment, the city, you know, the urban life, you know. Well, I just think the marketing that the MTA does is not top tier, because a lot of people don't know anything, you know. I mean, when the Kings last year were playing, you know, I had a friend write me a personal Facebook. He's like, I'm coming from Laverne. I'm going to the Kings game at Staples Center, you know, for the championships. He goes, the MTA schedule is not confusing, but it just takes too long to download and to scroll down. How do I do it?
Right.
And I said, okay, get on the goal line, take it to Union Station, get on the red line towards North Hollywood, take it 3 stops, get off on 7th and Metro, go upstairs to the blue line, 1 stop, drops you off in front of Staples Center, get a $5 pass, $2.50 each way from all that way, no parking. So it's really simple when you look at it kind of intuitively.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, they're running every 12 minutes, so you don't have to look at a schedule. It's pretty simple. You know, if you just know what lines to connect to, it's really simple. And I just think that the marketing needs a lot of work, because people don't know that all these options exist. A lot of people do, but the majority doesn't. You know what I mean?
It to me, for Southern California especially, it's a lifestyle change.
Yeah.
Is what it's going to take for it to be utilized by many more people. You know, the people who don't think it's even like an option for them, you know.
Absolutely. For instance, in my personal life, like, you know, just living right outside downtown over the bridge, I have a bus stop right in front of my house, a line 18, and basically, like, my core of my life is set up along the line. Like, I could take the bus over the bridge, get on the subway. I'm at my office in Hollywood in under an hour. If I'm driving, you know, it's about an hour.
Yeah.
That, 9 miles away. Now, the cool thing is, after work, I could get on the red line in Hollywood and take it to the last stop, North Hollywood, just right over the Universal border. And that's where my studio lockout is.
Oh, wow.
So and then I could go, like, play loud music. I could 10-minute walk or like a 5-minute quick skate. Get there, do my thing for 2 hours, get back to the red line station, and the straight shot, just like, you know, 20 minutes from North Hollywood to downtown, and then just back over the bridge.
Wow.
So you could do all this, you know, you're not binded to a car, you're not looking for parking, you're not paying for parking, and you could just really, you're just kind of like, you know, like the Bruce Lee thing, you're like water. You know, then all of a sudden, like, I'm done with rehearsal and it's like a Tuesday night and it's like, oh, this show's happening here. All right, let's get off on Hollywood Highland and go see this band for a minute. Oh, and then this band's playing to Redwood. Well, I'm going to go see them at 11:30.
Yeah.
And then if you miss the trains, it's like a $5, $7 cab ride.
Yeah.
If that's what you need to do, you know? So there's really a solid infrastructure that I feel. But I think we're going to play a few songs. Mike V is the in-studio guest. Good For You is his new band. Mike V, Greg Ginn, album out on SST February 26th. Vinyl available at all the indie record stores or direct from sstsuperstore.com. Let's play a few more tracks. Car Free Radio. We're back on the air. Welcome to Los Angeles Nista, episode 10. And this is January 28th, 2013. The anniversary of the Space Shuttle Challenger exploding in midair.
Wow.
I saw that in fifth grade in my classroom.
On your birthday.
On my birthday, dude. Now, happy birthday to me.
Happy birthday, Eddie.
So, yeah.
That was a messed up birthday when you were a kid.
I was 10 years old. It was 85. And I saw the Challenger explode in midair. And here we are today. We are coming to you live from downtown Los Angeles, California, Skid Row Studios. Obviously, if you're listening, you're streaming at skidrowstudios.com or you're, you know, playing your app on your iPhone or your Android. My in-studio guest, Mike V, professional skateboarder, Elephant Brand Skateboards, and the band Good For You. He handles lead vocals. We just heard a track. What was the track, Mike?
That was Knife in the Face.
And was that track five?
That's track five, yeah.
Track five, Knife in the Face.
Yeah, as opposed to Knife in the Back.
Yeah, you're not going to stab him in the back. You're just going to come right
out. Knife in the back, that's pretty standard. You can take that. Everyone just, you get stabbed in the back, you just keep going.
That's like industry standard, right?
Yeah, but when you finally arrive at a place where someone is so bold to put a knife in your face, you know you've hit rock bottom. That's what that song's about.
Mike, tell me what's going on with your musical taste these days. What are some of the bands you're listening to? It doesn't have to be new, but what's on, you know, when you wake up and you're going to take a bike ride, just when you're getting ready for your day, what are you blasting on your iPod or computer?
Dude, I listen to a lot of Kiss.
Oh, hallelujah.
And I listen to a lot of Kiss that people would consider bad Kiss or
okay,
self-indulgent
tell me.
Kiss.
Let's talk about this. No idea.
I like it all, man. You know?
So like non-makeup Kiss?
Non-makeup Kiss, yeah.
Oh, lick it up?
Yeah, lick it up, man.
You know what I just blasted the other day? Full blast in my house and it just sounded great. It was Creatures of the Night.
Yeah, that's one of their best
records. That's a serious record.
Yeah.
I mean, it just kept going like the intros with Eric Hart's drums,
yeah.
Creatures of the Night, and then, that song Keep Me Coming,
yeah.
And Killer and Rock and Roll Hell.
Dude, I like the grunge Kiss.
Oh, Carnival of Souls.
Dude, I like it.
Those are great guitar tones.
Dude, I like it.
Yeah. You know what I like? Revenge.
Oh, Revenge is great.
Unholy.
Yeah.
All the Gene songs are awesome.
Gene delivers on that record. Gene delivers on Creatures of the Night as well.
He carried that record, dude.
Yeah.
That was him.
Greg Ginn says Gene carries the band. Musically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Chuck Dukowski said the same thing.
Yeah.
So they might have a linear opinion on the demon. But for me, let me ask you a question. When was the last time you saw Kiss live?
2009.
And where was that at?
Honda Center. Yeah.
What'd you think of the show?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. It was great. It was everything that I expected. They deliver on the promise every single time. What a great band as far as being a fan, as far as the interaction and the delivery of what they deliver, what you signed up for, what you
exactly.
paid the ticket for, you know. And
they do a long set,
yeah,
like 2 hours minimum, sometimes 2.5.
Right. And I brought my youngest daughter to that show. That was her first, that was her second Kiss show. But we had front row seats that night. And
did you meet them?
Yeah, we did the meet and greet.
You did the meet and greet package?
And they were so cool. They were so cool to my kid. And they said, "What's your name?" Paul Stanley asked her, "Your name?" And she said, "Oh, I'm Lucy." He goes, "Lucy, where are you sitting?" She said, "Well, I'm in the front row." He goes, "All right, I'll be talking to you tonight."
And sure, imagine Paul Stanley telling you that before he goes on
stage. Sure enough, he said hello to her 20 different times. Like while guitar solos are going, he'd come over to the end of the stage. "Hi, Lucy."
That's cool, man.
The first two songs, these guys throw picks,
like 30 each, right?
So we got,
and they're already sweating.
Yeah. So we got a pick like in the first song, right? And we were like, "Oh my God, we got a pick." Well, dude, by the end of the night, we had so many picks. We had a pick for every extended member of our family. She got drumsticks from Eric. She got picks. She got, they were just like, she was the only little kid anywhere around in the front, you know? So she got all the attention. It was amazing.
So you could go on record and say, like, they truly, like, not only deliver the legend of their performance, but they treat their fans with respect.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
the experience backstage, I mean, they're all very kind and very, very generous.
Gene Simmons said to me, he goes, "What are you, like MMA?"
He told you that?
Yeah. And I go, "No, I skateboard." He goes, "Same thing."
He said that same thing?
Yeah.
And was that all he had for you? That was it?
Yeah, I was just like, whatever, man.
It's all the same
to Gene.
It's all same thing. Oh, that's classic. So how old was she when you took her to that concert?
I guess she was 10. No, like 8. Mm-hmm. 8, yeah.
Now, going back on the whole format of Los Angeles Nisa and talking about local business, you know, just historicals of cities, et cetera. You're into bikes. Do you get your bikes at a store in Long Beach? Is it a mom and pop?
I got my bike at Jack's Bicycle Shop.
Is that in Long Beach?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about them.
Well, there's Jack's Bicycle Shop in Long Beach. I have a Schwinn cruiser that I got in the mid 90s that I got there. And it's like a classic Schwinn cruiser. I mean, well, classic mid 90s classic.
Sure, sure.
You know, Schwinn's now a brand that's not really, you know, it's kind of like a toy store brand now. But it's a really good bike, you know, really good cruiser bike, 6-speed cruiser. And the whole family went to Jack's. Well, the whole family, that was the family then, this before Lucy was born. We all went and got bikes.
Awesome.
And the store is in the same neighborhood that we live in. So we just walked over to Jack's, got bikes, rode our bikes home. Yeah.
And that was how long ago?
That was mid 90s.
Wow.
I just got a new bike from Jack's, but I got it from the Jack's in Irvine. And it's real set up to be a commuter bicycle. You know, the cruiser's cool, but this bike's set up to put miles down and, you know, riding comfort.
Gotcha. But the original Jack's is in Long Beach.
Yeah.
That's great. And whereabouts is it, so our listeners know?
It's Bellflower and Spring.
Okay.
So right off the 405.
Kind of by Cal State?
Yeah. Up the road.
About 5 minutes? Yeah. I know that's it.
Yeah.
Since we're using Long Beach as the topic for the Los Angeles Nista format, let's talk about music venues. Let's talk about our experiences with Alex Bar.
Yeah.
Alex's Bar.
Yeah.
Now, you played there.
Many times.
Many times. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the times you played there. Okay. You played there with Mike V and the Rats.
Yep.
And you played there as a member of Black Flag.
I did. Well, now, a guest vocalist.
Guest vocalist. Well, when they did the reunion in 2003, Black Flag sold out 2 nights at the Palladium. And you guys did one surprise show. The Palladium was Friday and Saturday of September. And then Sunday night was a secret show.
Yep.
And Alex is now, you played, you know, on different, you've had different experiences with different bands, but you've played Alex's Bar quite a few times.
Yeah.
Have you gone to see bands as a customer?
Yeah.
Okay. Now tell us about Alex's. I mean, like, what do you think about that place? Do you think it's definitely an institution for Long Beach as far as music goes?
Oh, for sure. I mean, definitely a musical institution in Long Beach. You know, I guess you think about it as like a punk club, I mm-hmm, guess, mm-hmm. you know, but I mean, I'm sure the music scene's pretty diverse in there in a sense.
Sure.
I think it's a great place to see a band, you know, no doubt about it. As far as being in a band and playing there, it's tough. Southern California is just tough when you're going out playing.
Period.
You know? Period. You know, I think the night that we played there, where I did the spot with Black Flag was probably the best show I've done there. And I think that was great for me because the Palladium, I got up and I did it. Two nights. I just did it. You know what I mean? It was like...
Wait, let's back up. The first night when no one knew what to expect, what was going through your head when you walked on stage and saw 5,000 people and My War was starting?
Yeah.
Like, was it like this high that like is like exceeds?
Yeah. Well, I thought
pulling off a trick.
I felt like we were delivering, but you know, people couldn't get over the fact that there was a taped bass. You know, they couldn't get over the fact that who's this guy? Oh, some skateboarder. Like, you know, how does this make any sense? Oh, he's like Henry Jr. He's trying to do his best Henry impersonation. People couldn't get past all this stuff, you know, and really just hear what we were actually putting down. So that was just an intense, Now, I won't say confrontational. People were mad and they were throwing shit at me and it was, you know, whatever.
But at the same time, it was the aesthetic of what happened that night was true to the original shows because they opened with Process of Weeding Out for 10 minutes, which is like a hippie jam. And all these punks would just get pissed off.
Yeah.
And then when my war started, you know, it's Dale Nixon on bass, which is a pre-recorded bass. And Greg and Dez on guitar.
Well, Dale was in rehab at the time. That's why we had to use the pre-recorded bass.
Yeah, Dale was in rehab. And the guy who called, Gregory Moore, was on drums.
Right.
Okay. You know, barefooted for 20 years and you were on vocals.
Right.
And that was the beginning of one of those, the sets that you guys did. It just, you know, was so explosive from the balcony and just seeing the whole place.
I mean, I thought it was great. But
did that energy, like, was that a catalyst for you at all? To just keep giving it right back at him?
Yeah, I mean, the first night it was just a matter of just getting through it. You know, just had to get through it, man. It was like, the second night I felt like, okay, I kind of knew what more to expect and it was rising to the occasion type of thing. But the third night at Alex's bar in Long Beach, I owned those songs. You know what I mean? I felt like we really, people knew what they were going to get now. The Palladium shows had happened. And I think a lot of people came out to Alex's in a sort of confrontational way, like angry, but they were there. They packed, they filled the room, but they were kind of angry. And I think they wanted to hate it, you know, but they couldn't. It was real. It was authentic in the moment. And I felt really good about that show.
That's good.
You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, as an artist playing that stage, I mean, do you feel it's like you have great sound, the monitors? I mean, how do you feel about all that? The acoustics? Can you hear all the instruments while you're on stage?
You know, I think the hard part about for me for playing Southern California is I leave my house, my family, and then I go to a club and I play. And it doesn't feel, you know, when you're on the road, when you're touring, to me I'm in a different zone. I'm in a touring.
A touring zone. Yeah. A touring musician zone.
I have a hard time as a family man, you know, leaving my house, giving my kids a kiss goodnight or something, and then going and playing a show. It's like, it's hard to transition into, you know, it's not a job for me. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm not making any money doing this. This is something I'm very passionate about. But it takes getting on the road and living it, like living that,
to get
living that
zone.
Music, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
To be in the zone. The bands I've seen there, being there as a spectator, I've always enjoyed it. But I can't, it's hard for me to say I ever enjoyed playing any club in Southern California as a, you know, as a participant in a band. Cause it's a difficult situation.
Gotcha.
If I came through SoCal on tour, probably a different feel, you
right.
know? Because by the time I get here, I'd be in a different zone.
You'd be super warmed up.
Yeah. I mean, I wish it was like, you know, just like Clark Kent.
You just take off.
Yeah, but it's not that easy sometimes.
Then,
you know.
Well, let me ask you this. Left turn really quick. I've always wanted to ask you about this. You love Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, how many Bruce Springsteen concerts have you been to?
Can't count.
You can't even keep track?
I mean, most Springsteen fans, they know... You know, they keep track. Okay. They'll tell you every, you know.
What was the first year you saw him?
I don't remember. The first Springsteen show I ever saw was in Tom Joad Tour, which was 95, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now.
And I could have seen him a lot earlier, but I hated him.
you hated him. So what brought you onto the other side of the wall?
The music.
You started connecting to his lyrics?
Well, when I saw Black Flag in 1984, that's the same year Born in the USA came out. This is like polar opposites to me at the time. You know, I was Born in the USA, bunch of jocks in my school with bandanas on singing Born in the USA. Fuck that.
Imagine that shit.
Fuck that. You know, so it was an immediate turnoff. You know, immediate turnoff. So, it's something I dismissed. It's not something that I thought was relevant to me. And you know what? I missed out on a lot of great shows probably.
Right.
Springsteen's the man.
So you connected with him like in 94?
I connected with him before that, but I didn't see him until then. I've always been writing. I guess I called it poetry.
Sure. You have some books.
Right, yeah. But really, I was writing songs. You know, I wanted to do music. I wanted to be in a band. So I was always writing. And I was 90, I think 91 or 92, maybe 92. I was writing something and, you know, I'd been in California since late 88, living here. And I was thinking about where I grew up and, you know, and I started writing some stuff. It was the first time I'd ever thought about where I'd come from. And I was doing a lot of writing about that, kind of just filling up journals with lyric ideas or poems or journal type entries about, like, you know, the streets of my hometown kind of thing. And I took a break from writing one day and I turned on the TV and I turned on VH1 and there was a clip of Bruce doing a live version of My Hometown. And the words were like, it was like, I just wrote these words, you know, it's like,
wow,
this is intense, you know? So I'm just like, I went out and bought the record, right? And I played it nonstop. I couldn't believe how great it was. Like, you get past the synthesizers, you get past the 80s kind of sound. The songwriting was just so great. But I was like, in secret. I got to play it in secret. Like, my friends couldn't know I had a Bruce Springsteen record. You know what I mean? And one day, Ed Templeton and I were driving to Santa Barbara, and I just was like, this 10-disc changer in my car, and it came on. And he looked at me like, and I was like, what? and
Templeton,
since,
huh?
Yeah, and since that day, like, that's it. Like, that's it. You know, it's like, that was my, like, coming out of the closet.
All right. That's killer. So you can't even give us an estimate of how many Springsteen shows you've been to?
Over 20.
That's a lot.
Yeah. During the Rising tour, I was lucky enough to have credentials to go walk into any building, any city, and just walk right to the side of stage or into the pit and watch the show.
And what city was that? I mean, or what year was that?
That's 2002 or 2003.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've met him plenty of times. Oh,
yeah, man. Just this year, I brought my youngest daughter went to the show and got to meet him. And it was really cool, man.
That's cool.
He's another guy that's everything you think he would be. When you are in his presence, when you meet him, it's just like, dude, the boss, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That's killer. And I always get a kick out of how Max Weinberg is his drummer from,
dude,
you know, the Conan O'Brien show.
Whatever they're paying Max, it's not enough.
Exactly.
That guy.
He's the man, dude.
Listen, when you see a drummer that is so, that believes so much in the music that he's performing, like, he's not just Bruce's hired drummer, man. He's invested in the music. You see him up there behind Bruce, like, he's delivering the entire time. That's it's awesome. All passion, man.
And it cuts through live. Like, you just see the look on his face.
Yeah. He's singing along.
That's killer.
Yeah.
That's killer.
That's one other thing I'll just say about Springsteen is, you know, if you go to a lot of rock shows, people are just doing their jobs.
Whether they're phoning it in.
Yeah.
Dude.
Whether they're in the band or they're the crew, they're, you know, I've never been to a Springsteen show where I've seen the crew just like lazing around. They're watching the show. They're, you know,
they care.
They care. And Bruce, his shows are spontaneous enough that it's worth tuning into every night. He's not mailing it in. There's new things happen every single night that it's like, what's going to happen tonight? What song is he going to play? You know, what kind of interaction is he going to have with the crowd? And so it's something that...
So he changes his set list.
Yeah,
he's not on this routine for the same night.
No way.
Yeah.
And if you're on the road with him, like, you got to stay on your toes because he's on his toes. Like, there's, you know, there's nothing flat-footed about it. You know?
It's exciting.
Yeah.
Pretty intuitive way, you know?
Yeah.
So we've got a few minutes here. I wanted to give you the platform to tell everyone when is good for you playing your new band with Greg Ginn. What live shows you guys have booked?
Oh, let me take a look here.
I think I saw something. There's some Chicago coming.
Yeah, we just announced Chicago last night. Chicago's April 18th at Reggie's Rock Club.
Okay.
Well, we're starting out in Dallas on April 12th at Club Dada.
Okay, let me just say this. Good Records, Dallas. They'll have the record.
Okay, then we're on to Tulsa, Oklahoma on the 13th at the Downtown Lounge, Tulsa.
Size Records in Tulsa and Oklahoma City.
All right. On the 15th of April, we're in Des Moines, Iowa at the Gas Lamp.
No account in Des Moines, Iowa.
On the 17th of April, we're at the Crunchy Frog in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
How far is that from Milwaukee? Far, huh?
I don't have a map in front of me.
Well, there's Rushmore Records in Milwaukee.
All right.
And they care about independent music, so they'll put flyers no matter how far it is.
Most of the rest of the dates for April are just, we're still waiting for confirmations.
Sure.
We do have Fort Wayne, Indiana, the New Republic Skate Park, which is, I think, will be our only skate park date of the tour.
All right.
That's in Fort Wayne on the 26th of April.
That's killer.
And then we're confirmed for the Muddy Roots Music Festival in Tennessee.
And you guys are actually opening for Black Flag.
So, well, Black Flag's the headliner. I don't know when we'll play in the course of the two or three day festival, but
Greg is playing double duty. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's killer. And that's in Nashville?
It's in Tennessee. I think the city where the festival's happening is Adams, Tennessee.
Okay, because there's a great store in Nashville called Grimey's and one called Groove. The Groove. So that's it. That's a wrap. That is episode 10 in the books. Mike V, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, man.
We'll see you guys at episode 11.
Barely.